The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer and the New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we'll step back to read an article that may have been overlooked when it appeared in the fall of 2021, headlined 11 North Carolina Sites Added to the National Register of Historic Places, was published in the October 31, 2021 issue of the News and Observer. It was written by Dawn Bumgartner Vaughn. So let's learn some more, and this will be about some new sites and destinations that may interest you if you want to explore North Carolina. We begin. If you've ever driven down Oberlin Road in Raleigh, you've noticed the large green historic house close to the road that was moved and recently restored. That home, the Graves Field House, is one of 11 new additions from North Carolina to the list of houses, buildings, and districts in the National Register of Historic Places. Here's more about the Graves Field House in Raleigh being relisted and more North Carolina changes to the National Register of Historic Places just announced by the North Carolina Department of Cultural and Natural and Cultural Resources, I should say. And again, this was done in October of 2021. First, the Graves Field House, Raleigh. The two-story Queen Anne architectural-style home, now at 814 Oberlin Road in Raleigh, was built in 1886 and was listed in the National Register before it was moved. It is owned by Preservation North Carolina and used for offices in the same historically African-American community. Oberlin was once a freedman's village after the Civil War, now part of the city. The house was previously listed as the Willis M. Graves House and known as Oak Crest. When the house was listed before, it was located at its original address of 802 Oberlin Road, but was moved in 2019, minus some 20th century additions, according to the National Register of Historic Places, which also details the full history of the property. And if you're interested, you can check out www.nps.gov/subject/national-register/index.atm. Again, if you want more details about this or any other historic site in the registry, www.nps.gov/subjects/national-register/index.htm. Willis Graves, the original owner of the house, was a brick mason, and his wife, Eleanor Hinton Graves, was a school teacher. Their children and grandchildren went on to careers in law, journalism, education, and real estate. In the late 1920s, the house transferred owners out of the Graves family, and in 1945 was bought by Spurgeon and Janetta Fields, who were Oberlin residents, according to the National Register. Fields' heirs sold the property to real estate developers in 2016, leading to the relocation and restoration of the house by Preservation North Carolina. The Oberlin area is adjacent to the village district of shops and restaurants, recently renamed from Cameron Village because it was named for Duncan Cameron, who had been the largest antebellum slaveholder in the state. The nearby Cameron Park neighborhood is also going to be renamed. St. Stephen United Methodist Church in Lexington is our next place. St. Stephen United Methodist Church, a historically African-American church, was established in 1868 and is the oldest black congregation in the Lexington District of the United Methodist Church, or UMC. The sanctuary dates to 1921, and the 1892 classroom wing was once the sanctuary. During the 1960s, civil rights movement meetings were held at the Colonial Revival style church. Next, we have the Earl W. Webb Jr. Memorial Civic Center and Library, located in Morehead City. The Webb Center and Library in Carteret County is a Colonial Revival style public building from the 1930s, and that is all this particular writer had to say about that, so you'd have to research that for more. It's called, again, the Earl W. Webb Jr. Memorial Civic Center and Library, Morehead City. Then we move on to the Enfield Historic District, Enfield. The Enfield Historic District in southern Halifax County includes a variety of residential and business architectural styles from 1833 to 1972, including Greek Revival, Italianate, Queen Anne, Gothic Revival, Romanesque Revival, Classical Revival, Spanish Revival, Neoclassical, Colonial Revival, Craftsman, Period Cottage, Art Deco, Minimal Traditional, Ranch, and Modernist. Then we have the Elizabeth and Bowman Gray Jr. House in Forsyth County. New to the register is the Bowman's 1950 home at Brookberry Farm in the Louisville area. According to the National Register, it is an example of Winston-Salem architect William Roy Wallace's design of a Georgian Revival house. Next, Ella Brown Cannon House in Salisbury. The Ella Brown Cannon House in Rowan County is built in the Southern Colonial Revival style in North Carolina. This was built in 1905. We move on to the John N. Smith Cemetery in Southport. The Brunswick County Cemetery was added to the register for its social history and black heritage, according to the register. It was established in 1874 and served the black community's only communal as the black community's only communal cemetery until the Northwood Cemetery, two blocks away, was integrated in 1974. Now, Pilot Hosiery Mill is in Pilot Mountain. This historic Pilot Hosiery Mill in Surrey County was added to the National Register due to its role as one of three primary textile manufacturers driving Pilot Mountain's economy. The hosiery mill first operated in the 1940s and was later expanded. It closed in 2011. Robbinsville Downtown Historic District. Now, the Robbinsville Downtown Historic District was added to the list for its major economic development and prosperity era between 1872 and the mid-1960s. It includes the Graham County Courthouse, which had been listed on the National Register since 2007. South Asheville Cemetery and St. John's A. Baptist Church, Asheville. The cemetery and church were added separately to the register as a reflection of the development of the traditionally African-American community of South Asheville, weaving together the areas of settlement, community development, African-American ethnic heritage, and social history. The cemetery, dating to the 1800s, is the oldest cemetery for black residents in western North Carolina and began as a cemetery for people enslaved by William and Sarah McDowell. Now, some other register changes. We have St. Augustine's College campus in Raleigh also added, with more documentation, updating its significance in education and black heritage. Then we have the Mount Airy Historic District in Surrey County added updated documentation to the National Register, including its inventory list of current appearance and status of contributing and non-contributing buildings. And the Lee County town of Sanford adjusted boundaries of its historic district in the National Register. These boundaries have been expanded in three areas and reduced in three small areas to remove non-historic, altered, or vacant buildings. So there you have some interesting information that I hope you will find helpful. If you'd like to explore North Carolina, these all added, of course, to the latest National Register. Well, next up, I want to give you the website, the National Register, one more time. It's www.nps.gov/subjects/national-register/index-htm. This can be a great resource if you'd like to learn about historic places, whether here in North Carolina or in other states. And that might be interesting, especially your hometown. That also could be helpful. Well, historic places are among the many reasons people travel, but you may be among those people who would like to travel but are concerned about the pandemic and how it's going to affect you. Well, have you considered Travel is Healing? That's a question and a headline all in one there. And it's the title of an article written by Concepcion de Leon in the December 23, 2021 issue of the New York Times. Now, she found that wellness vacations now go far beyond massages and diet advice, instead offering a respite from the physical and mental stress that many are experiencing as a result of the pandemic. Her article explores what we might expect, so let's begin. Before the pandemic, when Mary Celeste, 32, traveled, She would try to hit as many tourist attractions as she could, but in early December, Ms. Celeste, who works in the financial services industry out of Plainfield, New Jersey, went to Guatemala and stayed at an eco-friendly hotel called Lush Adelon. There, she ate vegan meals, walked around the natural reserve, and listened to music, and loved it. From now on, she said, I see myself incorporating a lot more of my needs into my travel instead of what I can see. As the pandemic lingers into its third calendar year, it's probably not surprising that travelers are increasingly looking to their vacations to work on their mental and physical wellness. In a recent American Express survey, 76% of respondents said they wanted to spend more on travel that improves their well-being, and 55% said they would be willing to pay extra for those services or activities. That has hotels ramping up their wellness offerings, from outfitting rooms with Peloton exercise bikes to adding programs that address mental health. Hilton has created a program called 5 Feet to Fitness, which includes an interactive kiosk with fitness tutorials and a gym's worth of equipment in some rooms. At Miraval Resorts and Spas locations, guests over the past year have come in having experienced symptoms of stress that they quite frankly were unfamiliar with, said Simon Markser. That's the hotel group's associate vice president for wellness offerings. In April, Miraval partnered with the National Alliance on Mental Illness to create Journeys with Intention, a customizable wellness program that allows guests to choose from a selection of journeys according to their health goals. Among the offerings, self-connection, grief and loss, and mental well-being, as well as more standard spa, adventure, and fitness programs. What we're seeing, certainly in hospitality, is the need to serve the really whole person, Mr. Markser said. Well, that being said, spas took a hit, according to the subtitle here. Spas, with their focus on high-touch, one-on-one services like massages and facials, were hit hard last year. Hotel and resort spas experienced a 42% dip in revenues, while destination spas, which offer an immersive experience, were down 37%, according to a report by the Global Wellness Institute, published in December. But the wellness industry has since begun a rapid recovery, the report said, projecting that the spa sector will grow 17% annually through 2025. Still, the downturn forced hotels and resorts and their guests to expand their notions of wellness and what activities fall under that umbrella. Before the pandemic, a wellness trip was probably centered on a spa's traditional services, said Caroline Klein, the chief communications officer of Preferred Hotels and Resorts, a luxury hotel group. Now, hotels may offer nature walks, meditation, yoga, or any number of creative offerings. In some ways, hotels are responding to the lifestyles that many people adopted at the height of lockdowns, including making home-cooked meals and taking virtual fitness classes. Hotels are really seeing people bring those new mindsets, routines, and preferences with them as they start to travel again, Ms. Klein said. What that creates is a definite shift in expectations and experiences that hotels need to cater to, because they're not catering to the traveler from 2019. Emily Rossin, a spokeswoman for a hospitality group that includes The Writer, a boutique hotel in Charleston, South Carolina, said that after seeing the surge in popularity of Peloton bikes during the pandemic, the hotel decided to make them an in-room option for guests. We noticed that people were still stuck in their habitual routines from when we were in lockdown, Ms. Rossin said. When they're coming to stay with us, it's within their same routine, and they don't really have to break that. Established wellness hotels are also benefiting from the boom. Alex Glasscock, a co-founder of the Ranch Wellness Retreat in Malibu, California, which offers hours of daily hiking and a vegan menu, has seen an increase in bookings, he said, notably from teenagers and young adults. It's a significant shift from when he and his wife Sue started the company in 2010, and people were confused by the concept of a luxury boot camp. This is a truly mega trend, he said, adding that at the ranch, what we've noticed from the pandemic is that where people used to book 2 and 3 months in advance, now we're full 6 months in advance. Then we have another section titled Changing Travel Styles. What people want out of a vacation is shifting, said Chris Cam, the president and chief operating officer of OmniTrack, a Hawaiian-based research company that conducts regular national travel surveys. While travel has always been a reset during the pandemic, the travel experience transformed and became a place to heal from mental, physical, spiritual stress, he said in an email. People travel for answers now about how to feel better. Shasha Du, 33, a founder and creative director of Wild Awake, which organizes retreats for young people of color, said her travel style had changed. I used to love traveling to cities a lot more, she said, but looking back at that travel, which she said included a lot of shopping, Ms. Du realized it was enjoyable, but it was also not that fulfilling. It didn't nurture my soul, she added. In 2020, she designed two nature retreats for herself and her friends, and in November, she rented a barn north of Sacramento through Airbnb and for the first time signed up for an Airbnb experience, a tea foraging event where she learned about the ancestral medicinal uses of many plants, some of which she'd been seeing all her life. It was just a different form of self-care, but I felt it was really, really rejuvenating, she said. Feeling depleted by the pandemic, Ann Chen, age 58, an English composition instructor at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, recently booked a wellness retreat with a friend for June 2022, as she says, as a way to keep going, find something positive. They plan to stay at Ojo Santa Fe in New Mexico, a wellness resort with thermal pools, meals sourced from local farms, and a spa. They planned ahead for personal scheduling reasons, but also to give them time to research the area and understand its culture, attitudes, and beliefs, Ms. Chen said. The idea, she added, was to be soothed, to work on being calm, to work on eating good food. This kind of resort is getting us back to more of normal feeling in our lives, where we are just not so stressed out about worrying about whether we're going to live another day, Ms. Chen said. Industry experts say the wellness travel trend is here to stay. The United States accounted for nearly 30% of the global wellness tourism market in 2020, and the sector is expected to grow to $919 billion by 2022 from $735.8 billion in 2020, according to the Global Wellness Institute. This is where we were headed, Mr. Marxer of Miraval Resorts and Spa said. The pandemic has brought the future forward in an accelerated sort of way. Wow. So a lot to look forward to there in future travel, huh? Well, restoration following natural disasters is a theme that often involves tourist sites. In a special to the Washington Post, writer Elizabeth Heath found that resort destinations that rebounded after natural disasters were doing better. Her story was published in the December 19, 2021 issue of the News and Observer Extra Edition. I always get that a little jumbled up, but there we go. For three decades, the lodge at Gulf State Park was the touch point of the coastal Alabama communities of Gulf Shores and Orange Beach, the site for weddings and proms, the place to go for dinner, and a vacation destination for families from across the South. In Roseau, the capital of Dominica, the Fort Young Hotel had stood since the 1960s as one of the island's largest and best-equipped combinations. On an island in the Victoria Nile, the team at Uganda's Wild Waters Lodge was used to riding out the seasonal fluctuations in water levels. And in Australia's lush Gowanna Rainforest and the Benabira Lodge endured for more than 85 years, even as climate change altered the environment around it. In the space of hours, each of these accommodations were partially or fully destroyed, victims of the same rapidly accelerating climate change that's incinerating forest in the American West, causing deadly flooding in Europe, melting glaciers, and choking out coral reefs across the world. Collectively, they're just part of this larger global crisis. Individually, their losses were deeply felt within their wounded communities, and their rebuildings and reopenings were either symbolically or directly an essential part of community recovery. When nature stripped things down to the foundations, these lodgings were faced with a choice: rebuild in the same disaster-vulnerable manner or use catastrophe as an opportunity. Although their precarious positions in a rainforest on top of a river or in vulnerable coastal zones mean the future is anything but certain, their rebuilding efforts have sought to be more sustainable, more resistant to catastrophic weather events, and more in harmony with the natural environment around them. When 2004's Hurricane Ivan irreparably damaged the lodge at Gulf State Park, adjacent buildings, and park infrastructure, it wiped out not only decades of local tradition, but also an important local economic driver. The park had begun ecosystem recovery efforts when another catastrophe, the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill, caused further harm. Chandra Wright, director of environmental and educational programs at the lodge, recalls that before the spill, lots of people around the country weren't even aware we had beaches in Alabama. Images of oil-soaked seabirds and blackened shoreline were their introduction to the Alabama Gulf Coast. But a $100 million settlement to the state from BP, operator of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig, changed the park's fortunes. Most of the settlement went to park restoration, including the rebuilding of the lodge, which opened in 2018 as a Hilton-branded property. The from-scratch project has sustainability at its core. Instead of sitting directly on the beach as they formerly did, lodge buildings are now set behind the dunes and raised on pilings. The project meets international benchmarks for environmental and economic sustainability, best practices that, according to Wright, are the driving factor for every decision and carry us forward from an operations standpoint. The fortified new buildings, rated to withstand the winds of a Category 5 hurricane, have passed another crucial test. When Hurricane Sally made landfall in 2020 as a Category 2 storm and knocked out basic services across the region, the lodge never closed. Employees whose homes were uninhabitable, as well as first responders and insurance adjusters, were able to base there with limited power, as lodge chefs used grills and propane stoves to serve up hot meals for anyone in need. One of the tenets of sustainable tourism is to give back to the community, Wright says, and the lodge is an example of how to do it the right way. Weeks before Nile floodwaters inundated and destroyed large sections of the Wild Waters Lodge, executives Leanne and James Hay knew they were in for what Leanne refers to as an extraordinary event. The luxury lodge sits on an island in the river on the Uganda side of Lake Victoria, miles upstream from two dams that routinely release lake water. "We've always dealt with slight fluctuations in water level," said Leanne Hay, "but in 2019 and 2020, we saw record rainfall, and the water," she recalls, "just kept getting higher and higher." 2 weeks ahead of time, everyone living upstream was advised that the floodgates would be open to full capacity to relieve both the dams and the already flooded lake communities. The Hays had time to move most of the furnishings to higher ground and evacuate staff before the river swept through and lifted up structures from underneath, like a manhole cover in New York City during a storm, says James Hay. The prolonged intensity of the floodwaters rendered buildings unstable and unsalvageable. The first priority in rebuilding was to raise the level of the destroyed main lodge by about 5 feet, higher than the high water mark of the floods, and to change its orientation to be more resistant to future flooding. Pandemic shutdowns, when all movement within Uganda was essentially halted, presented an opportunity. A ready local workforce, many of whom had helped build the original lodge. The availability of workers and construction materials, all of which had to be transported to the island by canoe, meant that the rebuild, which started in late January, was finished in less than 6 months. "We had about 140 guys from the local village helping us," says James Hay, "and at one point we were the biggest employer in town. Local women made and sold meals to workers. With no government support for those left unemployed by the pandemic, the rebuild was a tremendous opportunity to create goodwill," James Hay recalls. "We proved to a lot of people that we were there for the long run, that we're proper partners," he says. "It was all about standing together." Benabira Lodge is engraved in Australia's collective memory. Established in 1933, the remote southeast Queensland Lodge, set in Lamington National Park, is considered Australia's first crowd-funded ecotourism project and has hosted tens of thousands of the country's school children and families. When the historic timber lodge and cabins burned to the ground in a September 2019 brush fire, its loss resonated across the country. "The property is very deep in the psyche of the people," says Steve Noakes, Benabira's chairman. "And for as bad as things were," Noakes says, "no one could have imagined the event was just the start of Australia's Black Summer. a period of bushfires that devastated the country and broke collective hearts around the world. Noakes says his first instinct was to push forward with rebuilding, even if he didn't know how the lodge would possibly bounce back. Not only did the inferno raise lodge buildings, but it also sucked so much moisture from the ground that when seasonal rains finally arrived, the only road leading up to the property soon collapsed. It was nearly a year before demolition could even begin. Funding from the Australian government, insurance payouts and member donations allowed the property to reopen to domestic visitors in September 2020, albeit in a limited capacity. More recent high-end accommodation, called Sky Lodges, were set away from the main lodge and survived the fire relatively unscathed. They serve as proof, Noakes says, that we can design and build tourist accommodations that can withstand a bushfire. But Benabira had always been a place where people of all incomes could come and experience the park. The fire, Noakes says, took out all the pricing range in the middle. Another $14 million is still needed to rebuild the main lodge and restore that mid-range. Until then, bunkhouses, campsites, and glamping tents will soon be joined by tiny houses, which are being funded through low-interest shareholder loans. In the meantime, Noakes and his team are trying to recapture the spirit of the former Benabira. When a staff member suggested that a surviving historical building become the heritage hub of the complex, Noakes says he heard Heritage Pub, and the lodge's favorite new socializing spot was born. This has never been just a place to sleep, eat, and go for a walk in the woods, Noakes says. It is a place to come together. On September 18, 2017, Hurricane Maria swept over the Lesser Antilles nation of Dominica, leaving virtually every dwelling on the island uninhabitable and completely knocking out the country's infrastructure, including roads, hospitals, and communications. Gregor Nassif, owner of both Fort Young Hotel and Secret Bay Resort, recalls that for days the only way to communicate was to write letters by hand and have someone walk to deliver them. That's how Nassif, himself waiting on an airlift rescue after being injured when a landslide destroyed his home, learned that half of the waterfront Fort Young property had been blown away. As he recovered in an Antigua hospital, he heard from someone who had been or had seen Secret Bay from a boat. All the roads were cut off that had been wiped out. Still, those losses seemed minor in the face of the devastation across the island. In the weeks and months after the storm, Nassif recalls, when you greeted a person on the street and asked how they were doing, the answer was always, "We have life." As he waited for insurance money to allow for rebuilding, Nassif and his team focused on the most pressing needs. We cataloged what each person had suffered, their injuries and losses, and raised funds from the past guests to help rebuild homes, put on roofs, and restore communities. Despite the damage, the Fort Young Hotel remained open as emergency housing for the displaced, as well as for our first responders and NGO staffers. We rationed food, water, and electricity, even to guests, Nassif says. Once construction began, the storm offered the chance to comprehensively address sustainability. And Secret Bay was already a lot further down the sustainability path, he says, and it received its Green Globe certification in 2019. So it looks like that hurricane created a huge opportunity and allowed for recovery. So some interesting places that tourists enjoy and will continue to enjoy because of those rebuilding efforts. And that, my friend, brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.